This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Is that if the Muslim sultans did not stand in the way of the Mongols, do you know what would happen to India? Do you have any idea what the Mongols would do in India? The Indians cannot imagine it. To understand what I'm talking about, just read what they did to land between China and Syria in those 50 years. Breaking idols was an Indian phenomenon. It was happening in India before the Muslims came. Hindus who belonged to different cults or different understandings of their deities, because you know Hindus worship different deities. They have different deities, different sects, and for that reason they attacked each other in the past and they destroyed each other's temples and idols. So when a lot of these Islamophobes or Islam haters nowadays talk about Muslim history in India, they point to one phenomenon, and that phenomenon is temple desecrations. Temple desecrations was actually not an invention of Islam and Muslims. It was not. To the contrary, we have evidence that Muslims left those temples alone that had no political significance as such at the time. Because temples in India were symbols of power. The power of the king and the state was directly linked to the deity in the temple. And this is exactly what was the case with the Greek mythology. You see, if you watch this movie, Troy, Brad Pitt, when Achilles, the Greek mythical hero, attacks Troy, the first thing he does is goes to the temple of Apollo and he cuts off the head of the idol to demoralize the enemy, the army of the enemy. This is exactly what was happening in India. In India, Hindu kings would invade other territories, Hindu territories, and these Hindus would be worshipping a different deity, and one Hindu king would raid another Hindu territory, and the first thing that Hindu king would do is to go to the temple, destroy the deity, burn the temple down, and that would demoralize the entire army of the enemy. Khalas, finished, game over. You know, God has abandoned us. This is how it worked, and this is one of the reasons why it was used as a weapon of war during the Middle Ages by Muslims and Hindus. Okay, that temple desecrations is a Muslim specialty. Muslims specialized in temple desecrations. They knew how to remove the blocks professionally from temples. They knew how to slice the idols. But this was not a Muslim monopoly. It was happening in India across the board. And Richard Eaton is a very good scholar from the US who has written extensively on temple desecrations in India. If you Google Richard Eaton, Richard E-A-T-O-N, Eaton, and then temple desecrations. Google Richard Eaton, temple desecrations. You will see articles on temple desecrations in India, and you will see exactly what the reality is. So you need to learn your history. You need to understand these things. Likewise, Mahmud Ghaznavi, who came into India, he was invading this territory to accumulate wealth. And he used propaganda to be successful, to recruit more volunteers from surrounding countries. And you know, when the call of jihad was made, many volunteers came and joined the armies. And they came into India, and not necessarily, as far as the king was concerned, for the sake of Allah or for the sake of Islam. It was partly because they wanted to accumulate wealth, as kings did in the Middle Ages. During the Middle Ages, medieval period, there were no rules and regulations. There was no United Nations. There were no Geneva Conventions or Bill of Rights or anything like that. These people, they did as they went along, basically. They made their minds up. They decided things as they went along. Right, so Mahmud Ghaznavi raided 17 times and he destroyed one particular temple called Somnath in Gujarat, in the current day region called Gujarat. Okay, so this was the first time when some Muslim armies approached India from the north. And Lahore, have you heard of the city called Lahore? It's in current day Pakistan. Became the capital, the Ghaznavid capital in India. The first Muslim stronghold in northern India was Lahore, amazingly. A lot of people don't know this, by the way. Lahore became the first Muslim stronghold. Again, gradually, the Ghaznavid power declined. And after the Ghaznavid, another power arose in the 12th century called the Ghurids, okay, led by a man called Mu'izzuddin Muhammad bin Sam Shahabuddin Ghori. Okay, and he was called Ghori because he came from a region in Afghanistan called Ghor. Okay, and Afghanis have a long history when we talk about India and India and Afghanistan. Most invasions from the north came through Afghanistan, and they came from Khyber Pass, which is in current day Pakistan, by the way. Right, so these armies came, they defeated some Hindu kings in the north, in particular a king called Prithviraj Chauhan. He was defeated in a battle, the Battle of Tarain, and the Muslim power was established in the north in the city of Delhi. Now the slave kings came to power, literally called slave kings. Okay, this is when the real power play started as far as the Muslims are concerned in India, when the Muslims became real political players in the political or the military landscape of India. When did this happen? If you want to take one date, I would say 1200. Easy to remember. What date? 1200. Easy to remember. Why 1200? Because this is the time when the rise of the Muslim power in northern India actually took a significant form. And this started with, again, Ghori, Shahabuddin Ghori, who had a number of Turkic slaves under him serving as generals. So again, remember the tradition of buying slaves from Central Asia and training them in military arts for them to become expert soldiers, fighters, generals, tacticians, all these things, right? So these Turkic slaves who were very good at fighting wars, especially when we look at the medieval warfare, they brought a lot of expertise with them. So he had a huge number of slaves bought from Turkic regions, Central Asia, okay, current day Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and what other stans are there? All these stans, right? They were at the time known as Mawara'un Nahar. Mawara'un Nahar actually means land beyond the river, literally in the Arabic language. Which river? River Oxus. Okay, that separates Afghanistan from Central Asia. Also known as Transoxiana, the region of Transoxiana, right? So these Turkic slaves were bought from these markets in this region, and they were trained in military arts. They became so powerful within the military apparatus that they became sultans. So when Mu'izzuddin Shahabuddin Muhammad Ghori, Muhammad bin Sam Ghori, was killed by an assassin in his tent, there's a place called Gujar Khan in Pakistan. Not many, many people, if you are from there, you would know what I'm talking about. This is where Shahabuddin Ghori was killed in his tent in 1206. And immediately after his assassination, his slave Qutbuddin Aybak or Aybak came to power. The name is very Turkic. He was Turkic. And I can imagine if you saw him, he would look like a Central Asian, you know. Have you seen Mongols? Yeah. You know, they have long eyes, flat faces, very distinct features. They look like that. These sultans were Muslims, they look like that. So he was a Turkic slave. Qutbuddin Aybak was sultan and he governed for 4 years. In 1210, he was playing polo in Lahore and he died having fallen from his horse. And he was buried in Lahore. His tomb is there in Lahore. After him came to power a very important figure, Sultan Iltutmish, Shamsuddin Iltutmish, again a very Turkish name, right? He came to power and he governed for another 26 years, from 1210 to 1236. He came to power, 26 years. And it was in his reign when the Mongols started to kill Muslims. When the Mongol invasions started, Genghis Khan and his army started to invade Muslim territory from the northeast, okay, from the Mongol territory, Mongolia, current day Mongolia. So Genghis Khan came out to avenge the murders of some Mongol merchants who were killed in the territory of Khwarizm Shah. Khwarizm Shah was the king of a very huge territory consisting of parts of Central Asia, Persia and the Middle East up to Iraq. He was a very huge king who had become so huge that he had killed all the other kings in these territories. Now, because only he remained as the king, no other kings remained, he could fight the Mongols alone. But he couldn't fight the Mongols alone. That was the problem. When the Mongols came in, he was on the run. And when he eventually got killed or died, the Mongols had taken all that territory. Now, what happened? India, the Indian Islam, what happened as far as the Muslim civilization in India is concerned is directly linked to Mongol invasions, amazingly. If Mongols did not invade Central Asia, which was predominantly Muslim at the time, the cities of Bukhara and Samarkand, and this is why I keep mentioning it, this is why I tell Islamophobes that no matter how hard you try to spread hate against Muslims, we have survived Mongol invasions. We survived Mongol invasions. And you don't know what that is. Once you study the Mongol invasions, you will know exactly what that means. And we will survive this. We will also survive this. Your hate, your lies, your peddling of misrepresentation of our faith is not going to work. It's going to fail. It is going to fail. And we will survive. We will last. This is the promise of Allah to us. And you know, when the Mongol invasions happened, Muslim scholars are saying, this is it. This is Malhama. This is Ya'juj and Ma'juj. It's finished. We are finished. But what happened? These same Mongols, they became the defenders of Islam. They became the defenders of Islam. So from the same people came who? The Ottomans. The Ottomans. It happened in the 13th century. Genghis Khan came in 1219 and he died in 1227, having killed almost 10 million Muslims from East Turkestan up to Syria. And then an army of Mamluks, Saifuddin Qutuz, defeated the Mongols for the first time on that scale, and their advance was checked. Amazingly, the Mamluks, the Turkic slaves who were trained in military arts, have this honor to claim in their history. Both cases where Mongol invasions were stopped and checked, they were stopped by the Mamluks, by slaves bought by Muslim sultans, Muslim kings, trained in military arts. They were the ones who defended and protected the Muslim civilization from destruction, from imminent destruction. Where? One case is Egypt, where again the Mamluks, the slave kings were governing. Saifuddin Qutuz was a Mamluk, and Baybars after him. And the second case is India, where Sultan Iltutmish, who was governing when the Mongol invasions happened. And after these invasions, you remember when I mentioned that Indian civilization, Indian Islam, owes its existence to Mongol invasions. Sometimes when you see something, some destruction, you see destruction. But Allah has another plan. God has another plan. And you cannot see that plan unfold because you don't live long enough to see that plan. The Mongol invasions made Muslims stronger. And this is the point I want to make now. All the intellectuals, all the philosophers, all the poets, all the theologians, all the historians from Central Asia, all the artists, all the experts in architecture, the cream of the crop, the cream of the crop from Central Asia, and it's a huge region, from places like Samarkand and Bukhara, from the Fergana Valley, and from Afghanistan, they migrated. They left their region because of Mongol invasions, that destruction. And where did they go? India. They took refuge under the protection of these powerful sultans in India. And in India, all of these scholars and all of these architects and intellectuals brought their knowledge and their expertise with them. That's why India became such a power that a menace like Mongols could not shake it. For over a century, Muslim sultans from different dynasties governing North India were protecting India against the Mongol invasions. So first, Sultan Ghiyasuddin Balban, another Turkic slave of Sultan Shahabuddin Ghori. After Iltutmish, 1236 he died, his daughter Radia Sultana came to power. You know, Radia Sultana is a very famous figure in the Indian history and Indians know about her. She only governed for 4 years and she was the first Muslim woman ruler of India. She governed for 4 years and she governed effectively. In fact, Sultan Iltutmish preferred her over his sons. He used to say, "I wish you were a man, that you could become the Sultan after me," because she had all the qualities of the Sultan. But the Turkic governing system these slave sultans had established in India at the time was a very male-dominated system. So these Turkic leaders, chiefs, did not accept her as the ruler. So she was eventually deposed, and then other sons of Iltutmish came to power, but they were weaklings, and then came to power Ghiyasuddin Balban, a very powerful Turkic slave general, again trained in military arts, and he created a huge empire in India, so strong that the Mongols could not break through. He built fortresses in the way of the Mongols, okay? But one thing Muslims don't know about India is that if the Muslim sultans did not stand in the way of the Mongols, do you know what would happen to India? Do you have any idea what the Mongols would do in India? The Indians cannot imagine it. To understand what I'm talking about, just read what they did to land between China and Syria in those 50 years. You know what they did in Baghdad in 1258, the Mongols? In Baghdad, they killed the entire population. They left out the Shias, they left out the Christians, they completely slaughtered the entire population of the Sunnis of Baghdad. So the Mongols were stopped by the Muslim sultans. Muslim sultans stopped the Mongols, and if the Delhi sultans did not stand, the sultans who were slaves initially and they became kings, sultans. In this case, Ghiyasuddin Balban. Ghiyasuddin Balban governed from 1266 to 1286, 20 years. So Ghiyasuddin Balban was a very strong sultan. His son was killed in battle defending India against Mongols. Prince Muhammad Waliul Ahad was killed in battle against Mongols. And then we move on to the next dynasty that came to power, the Khalajis, another Afghan family from Afghanistan. They came to power, they fought against Mongols. Then came the Tughlaqs, also a Turkic, originally Turkic family from slave class who became sultans and kings. They also fought Mongols, and one of the kings among them was Muhammad bin Tughlaq, who governed from 1325 to 1351 for almost 26 years. He was the strongest sultan among the Tughlaqs. And who knows Ibn Battuta? Who knows Ibn Battuta? Ibn Battuta, the Rihla of Ibn Battuta, the memoir, the travelogue of Ibn Battuta is well known among Muslims in Muslim scholarly circles. He was a traveler who came from Morocco and he traveled all the way to India. He visited India at this time when Muhammad bin Tughlaq was governing. Muhammad bin Tughlaq appointed him as the Qadi of Delhi on the Maliki Fiqh, and then sent him with some presents and gifts for the Chinese emperor. So he sent him as an envoy to the Chinese emperor, and then he was shipwrecked near the south of India, and Ibn Battuta decided to go back to Morocco instead of going back to Delhi because he knew the Sultan will kill him. for losing all the things he was given for the Chinese emperor. So all of this is happening. I will now take a huge leap because of the shortage of time. We will go to the Mughals. The Mughals came to power, again a Turkic family originally. They were descendants of Timur the Lame, who was a conqueror after Genghis Khan, who conquered a large territory in Central Asia, again following the footsteps of Genghis Khan, and he went as far as the Ottomans, and he actually fought against the Ottomans and captured the Ottoman Sultan Bayezid Yıldırım was captured by him and killed by him. Okay, so Timur was very dangerous. He actually invaded India as well in 1398 and devastated Delhi. But from his descendants came a man called Babur, Zahiruddin Babur, who invaded India, and the Mughal dynasty was established in India. Persian language became the court language of India. Okay, it was the literary language of India. All the court records, the letters, the correspondence was done in Persian. And the sultans spoke Turkic. They spoke Turkic. But the language of the court was Persian. So Persian language went through a renaissance in India. So India, if we study the Mughal period alone, when they governed for nearly three centuries, Mughals governed parts of India for three centuries, and they made huge contributions. The Mughal Empire, the Mughal civilization was so influential and so powerful that even the Hindus had become Persianized or Islamified. Okay, so what happened to Hindus in India? What happened to them? They knew the Sanskrit, but they had become so influenced by the Muslim civilization that they had become Islamified. They were using Islamic language. In many cases, many Hindus came to Islam because of the beauty of Islamic culture and Islamic tradition in India at the time during the Mughals. I cannot paint all the Mughals as the same because they were different. Different kings did different things at different times in different places, right? But generally speaking, the Mughals had a very positive impact on the Indians. You know, I can talk about the Taj Mahal, I can talk about the Red Fort, I can talk about the Mughal monuments and the buildings and the art on tombs and the calligraphy and illumination of buildings and all that. I can talk about that. But the real achievement of the Mughals in India was their tolerance towards the masses, the coexistence of the Muslims and the Hindus and the others under the Mughal rule. The Mughals provided that justice, that stability of state. It wasn't perfect. It was never perfect, because those times were chaotic. Wars, rebellions caused problems. But if you look at the norm, people lived in enough peace to be able to write books like that. And I recommend strongly a book written by a scholar called Audrey Trusk. She has written a book titled The Culture of Encounters, Sanskrit at the Mughal Court, or in the Mughal Court, A Culture, or The Culture of Encounters, Sanskrit at the Mughal Court. And another book she has written, which is a short book on one of the emperors in whose reign this particular manuscript was penned, Aurangzeb Alamgir, who was the most Islamic Mughal king. Islamic, you know, he was the most Islam observant king in the Mughal history, and he was the man responsible for building the Badshahi Mosque in Lahore, which was the largest mosque in the world until other mosques were made later on. Even today, if you look at the Indian language in India spoken by the Hindus, it is heavily influenced by Muslim vocabulary, Muslim dress code, Muslim culture for that matter. This cannot be taken away from India. So the Muslim civilization in India achieved hugely positive things for the Indians and India. Muslim contribution to the freedom movement against the British East India Company and later on the British Empire. Wallahi, the list is so long that we cannot possibly. Muslim freedom fighters, kings like Tipu Sultan. Tipu Sultan, again, this is another lecture in itself. The man was killed in battle in 1799 against the East India Company forces. And he was so sophisticated that his name is among one of the inventors of rockets. If you go to the American Rocket Institute, if that's what it's called, you will see his name among one of the inventors. The British went to India as traders during the Mughal period. They came when the Mughals were at their peak, the peak of their power. The Mughals were the most powerful political entity in the world, starting from an emperor called Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar, then his son Jahangir, Nuruddin Jahangir, then his son Shahabuddin Shah Jahan, the builder of Taj Mahal, and then his son Aurangzeb Alamgir. These four kings, they witnessed or they saw or they facilitated the peak of the Indian empire in the world. During the reign, during the nearly 50 years reign of Aurangzeb Alamgir, from 1658 to 1707, India was the richest country in the world. It has been never so rich, before and after. And Aurangzeb Alamgir is the most maligned Muslim king in Indian history because of his Islam. But he made India a formidable power. Never before India witnessed so much power. 24% of global GDP, 24% of global GDP was in India during the reign of Aurangzeb Alamgir. This is how powerful India was. He was the richest man in the world. And yet, he would sleep on a mat. He memorized the Quran after he became the emperor when he was over 40 years old. He would write the Quran in his own hand. And he would deliver justice personally for his subjects. When he would hear one of his sons or one of his cousins or one of his relatives is abusing power, he would personally get involved. And he would have amends made. So Aurangzeb Alamgir was that. But then after his death in 1707, within 50 years of his death, the Mughals went downhill immediately. The succeeding emperors were a bunch of weaklings. They were busy in debauchery. They were, you know, having fun. Their harems, they're singing and dancing, they're smoking of shisha or hookah or all of that. This is what they were busy in. Okay, and then political power was lost. In 1757, the British fought a war against the Mughals and defeated them. And then they woke up to the potential of India. They realized that they can possibly own India. In their wildest dreams, these merchants working for a company, a trade company called the British East India Company, they could never imagine that they will one day become the masters of India, the richest country in the world. What Britain is today is one of the richest countries in the world, right? A huge proportion of the British wealth or the gold reserves of the Bank of England, a huge part of it comes from India. I tell you that without hesitation. Okay, if you don't believe me, read the book of Shashi Tharoor titled The Dark Empire. The Dark Empire. Okay, Shashi Tharoor. So, the British came to power in 1757 and slowly and gradually by plotting, by planning, which anyone would do, we can't blame them for that. Okay, British East India Company wanted to get its hands on power and own India, which they successfully did. They could not claim, however, ownership of India until this man called Tipu Sultan was killed in 1799. Why he was killed? Who was he? What are his achievements? Please either listen to my lecture on him on YouTube, the biography of Tipu Sultan, or read a book on him called The Tiger of Mysore by Kate Brittleback. Kate Brittleback. And Tipu Sultan was the last giant standing in India. Until Tipu Sultan was alive, the British could never claim racial or cultural or religious or political superiority over the native Indians. It was only in the 1820s, after Tipu Sultan was killed and the Muslim political power was removed completely from the Indian landscape, then the British would claim racial superiority. Then racism could be seen in the government policies. It could be seen how communications were done between the British officials. I recommend two books strongly to understand this point by a British author. His name is William Dalrymple. William Dalrymple has written two books on this very topic. To understand what I'm talking about, read White Mughals. White Mughals by William Dalrymple and The Last Mughal by the same author. And you will get the end of the Muslim empire or Muslim civilization in the Indian subcontinent.